Hello and welcome. I'm Simon King, and this is another episode of Nature Space with Hates. For those who are tuning in for the first time, Nature Space is a podcast where we dive into discussions about nature conservation, wildlife, and making the world a better place for both animals and humans. And we're really interested in talking to people who are out there taking a leading part in nature conservation. And of course, we're all about inspiring you to work alongside nature, so wherever you are in the world. Today, we have a very special guest with us. He's the custodian of one of Britain's finest historic houses, Castle Howard. It's a place like no other. We'll be finding out why. It's located in North Yorkshire, England, approximately 50 miles north of the city of York, and it's one of Britain's finest stately homes and has been the home of the Howard family for over 300 years. And so to set the scene, the estate is set within 1,000 acres of landscape gardens, parklands, and rural farmland, making it a notable point of interest, not just for its architectural grandeur, but also for its scenic, natural surroundings. And it's a popular destination for tourists. I've been there myself, and is often used for various events, including concerts, garden shows, and even film and television productions. And famously for those who are around about my age and a little bit older, Brighthead Revisited. So without further ado, let's give a warm welcome, if we can, to Nick Howard.
Good morning. How very nice to be here.
Good morning, Nick, and welcome. Thanks for joining us on Nature Space with Hate. So let's get started, shall we? I mean, I'm hoping that was a pretty good introduction, but to be fair, how do you feel? Did I sum it up nicely?
It's a wonderful place. Quite good. There's a few more than 1,000 acres here. We've actually, the estate is about 8,500 acres. Wow. So it's just the parkland and gardens that are 1,000 acres. So the central core of it.
Fantastic.
But it's always been about the surrounding countryside as much as about the buildings themselves, hence the place like no other moniker. We've got a lot of trees here. And when the third Earl of Carlisle built this place, one of the pieces of, I suppose you could call it sculpture rather than a building, that he put as a marker was the obelisk, which sits at the top of the drive. It's a very tall obelisk that points up into the air, and it was ostensibly put up as a memorial to Marlborough's victories in France, but really he was a memorial to himself, because he put on the other side of it a little ditty which said, "If to perfection these plantations rise, if they agreeably my heirs surprise, this faithful pillar will their age declare as long as time these characters will spare." Well, he was really saying, I'm planting a lot of trees here. I'm never going to see them myself, but I hope they look nice for the people in the future. And it's that attitude, I think, which is really important here, which is that you're not just dealing with the present, you're dealing with the future as well. So it really encompasses the real meaning of heritage, which is something that has been or may be inherited. So it looks both ways. It's a very important part of the place.
That's a great opening, and we'll come back to that, because we know that, you know, in terms of our ancient woodlands have all but disappeared. I think something like 4% or something is the latest figure. I might be wrong, but we know. But I'm interested in how you do this, really, in terms of smelling of the future and really stinking of the past. How do you move forward? How do you make decisions that you know, as you say, and you know, you won't see these things come to fruition, but actually, no, that's a great way to live life in some respects, you know, planting for the future.
Well, I think a lot of us who have to deal with land in any form are conscious of the fact that there've probably been some mistakes made over the last 50 or 70 years. But in particular, there's been an awful lot of chemicals put onto the land. I mean, people were, in some areas, really farming the subsidy rather than farming the land.
Right.
And it means, we know what the results of that are. We've seen them all around. And one of them, of course, is the terrible drop in water quality that we've got. Because, of course, these chemicals pour off the land and into the water. And here we've got a lot of ornamental water, and we really notice what's happening to it, because every year there's more and more algae on it. It's right. Just richer and richer, and the stuff just grows and grows and grows. I mean, the fountain here in the middle of the gardens is sometimes just got a blanket weed over the top of it. It's solid.
Yes.
And there's almost nothing we can do about it other than starting to change the way in which we use the land.
Yes, interesting. We'll come on to some of the fascinating things you're doing, really, in the ground itself, and perhaps some stories how you're improving the biodiversity and so on of the Castle Howard ground as well. But I think our podcast listeners really are also just as interested in the people we're talking to as well as the work they're doing, really. So I'm just wondering, can we start possibly by, you know, what do our listeners need to know about you, Nick, really, to get the most from this podcast, from this chat?
Well, I mean, it's always a difficult thing to say, but I suppose one of the features, given the sort of the concentration that you're making on the natural world and so on, is that I suppose I would say I'm a child of the 60s. And I think in the 60s, there was a brief moment when people were starting to become more aware of what was around them. Mm-hmm. And rather than just in the endless struggle to increase urbanization, started to become slightly more aware of the countryside. So I suppose that was a route for me. But certainly over the last 15 years or so, I've become more and more aware of the fact that we need to take a more responsible attitude towards our custodianship of the countryside, and that you need to start doing what was done in the past, which is to look to the future again, and to look to leaving my descendants something that's healthier than when I took it on.
And talking of taking it on, can you tell us, our listeners, more about the rich history of Castle Howard? Just give us a brief overview.
Yeah,
brief is a challenge, I imagine.
My family have always lived here. It was built by my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, the third Earl of Carlisle, who built it, who used Vanbrugh and Hawkesmoor to build it for him. And they must have had a fantastic relationship, because it's very hard to see where one person's idea starts and another one's ends. It's just an endless process of design and style. And it must have been as a result of great conversations that went on. I mean, there are several good jokes here, which I won't go into at the moment. Well, I mean, inside the house, this is a pretty grand house that they were building.
Yes.
And right in the middle of it, there's the Great Hall, which is, for those who know it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. For those who don't, it's an enormous space surmounted on the outside by a huge dome with a gold lantern on top of it.
Right.
And inside the ceiling is a painting. Now, there are paintings all round the hall which have various classical subjects. They have the four elements, they have the continents, they have the signs of the zodiac. And they must have sat there thinking, well, what are we going to ask Mr. Pellegrini to put in the ceiling? Well, everybody then who was educated in the classics, and particularly in Ovid's Metamorphoses, which had these great stories, which really defined the human condition in all sorts of ways. And their eyes must have lit up with glee when they decided they would tell the story of Phaeton, because Phaeton is the great story of overbearing arrogance in the classical tradition. And to put inside a dome with a gold cupola on it in the middle of the North Yorkshire, of the Yorkshire hillsides, a picture of the story of overbearing arrogance, I think shows a great deal of self-awareness.
Sir Christopher Wren had a part to play in the dome.
In that Hawksmoor had worked for Christopher Wren on St. Paul's, so he'd learned how to build domes. Domes are very difficult things to build because they want to push outwards all the time.
Right.
They are, because they're circular structures, the forces work outwards in every direction. Mm. So you're kind of forced into putting underneath it a thing that looks like the central transept of a church. And the central transept of a church is like that, because it often has a dome on top. So you have great arches, which are completely functional. They're supporting the dome above and stop it from splitting the house apart.
Fantastic. It is amazing. I've seen it. It's incredible, really. And I will put some in the show notes. We'll put some links, and so people can see what we're talking about as well. So, I won't do it any justice, really, if I try and wax lyrical about it. It's just amazing. So go and see.
You're quite right.
So while we've got you then here, I'm wondering what kind of things might you be able to share with us that aren't in, what might the public might not know about Castle Howard? What we've got, and there's only me and you. Nobody's going to listen to this, Nick, are they? So what are the secrets?
What are the secrets? Well, it's very hard to think what the secrets are, because I try not to keep anything secret. But no, we've got, I mean, if you look at our great lake in front of the house, there are three what we call reflecting ponds there, and they're all at different levels going down to the lake. So particularly at this time of year, when you get these lovely sunsets, they glow the most wonderful colours, and they take it in turns to do it, which is fantastic. But in the nearest one, we've got a whole lot of coils hidden underneath there, which provide ground source heating for us and provide all the background heat in the house during the winter. And it cut our fuel bills by an enormous amount. You still need electricity for the compressors in a ground source heating system, but you don't need any oil, you don't need any gas. So it keeps you warm without having to pay an enormous amount for fuel, and also without, of course, spewing stuff into the atmosphere.
Yes, and I imagine really in terms of the challenges, paying for fuels or at least heating and keep the upkeep of a place like Castle Howard must be absolutely incredible. It's this balance,
enormous.
I suppose,
it's
isn't
enormous,
it?
Yes, it's the power usage is huge, particularly with sometime like Christmas, which is just coming up, and we have an awful lot of lights and sound systems and necessarily backup heating in the house. So we're always running quite close to the edge at Christmas time.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a balance, really, isn't it? Because for example, solar panels on the roof of Castle Howard, is that something we would see?
Yes, I would think of it. I mean, it's slightly difficult to know where to put it. We would never be able to put them in a place that was actually visible from the ground, because I don't think listed building consent would allow that. But there are places where there's a parapet which hides it. And I've thought quite a lot about possibly doing this. They're south-facing roofs. It's just that at the moment, those roofs are over the part of the house that was burnt in the fire of 1940. And we're just starting to approach restoration work on quite a lot of that. So there's no point in putting solar panels on until we're absolutely certain the roof will remain at the same level it is. Because when it was restored after the war, after the fire, it was put back in a different place, the original roof. So we may want to move it back. When I was a child, there was over two-thirds of one front of the house. There was no roof. There were no windows. There was no first floor in. You stood on the stone floor and you looked straight up at the sky. You saw birds flying in through the old windows. You saw fireplaces halfway up the wall. You saw staircases, the pattern of them rising up. And my father was, regarded as completely mad by some people, but he moved back in and started restoring that. The dome was burnt off. He put that on in 1960, restored that. He put a roof back on, he put windows back in. He started to do work at the time of the Bryceshead film on restoring rooms. And we're literally at the moment, right at the beginning phases of restoring another room in that series, which will complete the tour of the house. Nobody will have to walk through burnt out rooms anymore. We'll have a tapestry room back, which we had in the past, which we still have the tapestry for, that were woven for the rooms in the early 18th century. So it's going to be very exciting.
Oh, mate, that is exciting. And you remember that as a child, looking back up at the building and being able to see through. Oh, that. Do you take something like this on? I mean, what level was it in terms of, I don't say completed, because I suppose places like this are really never, well, maybe you'll tell us, but it's an ongoing battle.
Battle. I mean, it took 100 years to build this house, because Carlyle had always wanted it to be as much about the outside as the inside. So they got about three quarters of the way through it. And he said to Vanbrugh and Hawksmoor, you've got to stop building the house now and start doing the things we talked about doing outside. So they built the temple and the mausoleum, and they started work on Ray Wood. They laid out the gardens, and they made it really the beginnings of what it is today. And that's gone on ever since. So, you know, in the 19th century, quite a lot was changed in the gardens. The waterworks were added to. So you've just got this tremendous sweep of landscape and built environment and a natural environment, which all just blends from one end to the other all the way through the estate.
Yes.
I mean, it is one of the most exciting and beautiful things about the place.
Yes. I mean, I'm laughing because it's this point. We moved recently from our place in Lincolnshire, northeast Lincolnshire, into a little market town, Louth, capital of the Lincolnshire Wolds. That's our claim to fame. But we have a building that we're in this project really of handing over commercial space back to nature. And I'm really, I'm interested in, you know, personally, I mean, in talking to you to fathom out how we make these decisions that, when you look at a set of accounts, you might think, well, it would be easy to do one thing, but actually let's invest it. Let's build another pond, or let's plant some more native species. Let's do things that last.
Yeah, I think we're all very conscious now of the responsibilities that custodianship of the land actually hold. So it's a time for really re-examining, when you've got quite a large landholding like us, re-examining all the different parts of it and seeing whether they're actually being used in the proper way. And so, for instance, there is one section of land that is very heavy land. It's known as Bog Hall, in fact. I lived there once many, many years ago when I was playing in a pop band. We sat there, we did our thing in the countryside. But that land is a very good example of land that's largely been farmed for the subsidy in the past rather than for the real quality of it.
I see.
And we've been looking over the last few years at just how we can change the way that we use it without actually having a terrible effect on our finances. And I think we've found a way through. So it's a question of watch this space, but I don't like using the word rewilding because I don't think any of England is wild, particularly England is wild anymore, and hasn't been wild for many, many hundreds of years. We've been a farming country for thousands of years, really. So I try and think of it in kind of slightly more pluralistic ways, so that I'm looking at the way in which we can increase biodiversity, that we can improve our carbon footprint, that we can bring back biodiversity. And that's what we're going to be doing down there. So there's going to be woodland pastures. There's going to be re-wetting. We're going to, obviously, one of the things that happened, particularly in the 50s, were a lot of ditches were dug to try and dry out land to make what was previously unusable land into usable agricultural land. So you dried it out, poured chemicals onto it, and planted it. Well, we're going to be blocking up some of those ditches so that the water comes back again. That won't take very long, I can assure you, in Bog Hall. There's going to be a lot
of the right name.
Yeah, it has got the right name, and it's very exciting. It's very exciting, and we're going to be where we hope that it's going to that we found ways in which we can accelerate its return to a more natural state, and then we can show people what we're doing.
Yeah, talking of showing people, I mean this 100 years building process. I'm thinking about how the role that Castle Howard must have had with the local community over that time and also to date. What kind of things do you do, and how important have the local community been?
Well, it cuts both ways. You know, we have. We're probably one of the biggest employers in the area because, you know, we have it's a seasonal business, but with the tourist part of our industry, the visitor part of our industry requires an awful lot of manpower. Mm-hmm. So there's seasonal work there, and we're just coming up to one of the big times of seasonal work, which is Christmas.
Yes.
So there'll be a lot of people in there. There's, you know, we own a lot of the land around, but some of it is tenanted. So again, there's, you know, you're into the third generation tenant farmers. There's a very close-knit community around the place. And I suppose we probably have to be a leader as much as anything else here. So in terms of re-examining the use of the land, it's not just what we do with the land that we have in hand, but we need to talk to other people, to our neighbours, to our tenant farmers and so on, because there's no point in just doing it in one spot.
Yes.
You really have to start bringing this responsibility back in a larger area. So that's a question of cooperation.
So I suppose those, I mean, I was born in the 60s as well, so that's only towards the back end of it, but that kind of, you know, that element of protest and examining things seems to be in me for some reason, really. And yeah. I do think about what I think about this traditional stately type home thing in my mind, which is long avenues of, or let's think of grass. You know, the most important thing is very green grass, lots of stripes, everything absolutely, you know, this Lutyens type feel to how things are built here and there.
It's funny you should bring that up, actually, the grass element, because obviously grass management is a huge part of the things we do. There's, as you say, the grass beneath the avenues, but there's a lot of grass in the grounds here.
Yes, yeah.
And some of it obviously does need to be nice, closely cropped lawns. But one of the things we've been doing over the past few years is to let more grass grow up, partly just to see what's there. Because you know, sometimes if you let grass grow out, all you get is docks and thistles and nettles and awful things. But there's a couple of areas that actually during lockdown we started to let grow, partly because obviously there were fewer people working here to cut it, but also because there was no public coming around, so we could do it. And we really had some quite satisfying results in that this grass grew up beautifully, lots of different patches of different types of grass, Yorkshire fog waving all the way through it.
Really?
But we started to see wildflowers coming back. Right. And over the last few years, the orchid return has been fantastic.
Yes.
Where we haven't cut the grass, we've started to see an awful lot of old flowers returning, coming up through it. And really, the only problem that we've got in terms of what we used to call weeds is ragwort. And even that, in the areas that we're particularly keen on, hasn't been too bad this year. I mean, it's been a terrible year for ragwort generally. But that's been all right. So it's really exciting watching that growing up, because the birds and the insects love it.
Yes, interesting that you say used to call weeds. And I think, you know, it is a matter of opinion, really, sometimes.
Yeah.
One man's weed is another man's wildflower. And
that's
so on.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
So you're exploring that.
I mean, I remember
that.
My mother always used to say, it's such a pity that rose bay willow herb is a weed, because it's such a nice flower. And, you know, you get these beautiful purple swathes that appear at that time. You then get left with this slightly rank-looking thing afterwards.
Yeah. We're in Shakespeare country here. This is like rose by any other name as well as sweet. Absolutely.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Fascinating, though. I think the time is right that we're on an... we could have moved our business to to farmland. We could have moved it into the countryside. And although we're on the edge of the Lincolnshire Wolds here, we're on an industrial estate. And that's where we wanted to be, because what we wanted to prove was that you can run a business alongside nature. And that's why we have our ponds. We will have our wildlife attenuation ponds, and we're planting native species. And we think it's possible to have, and we should do, really. We're a wildlife company, but we didn't want to do this in a farm, because then we could just, it's like a pop-up, we wanted a bit of a challenge, really, and that's why we came to an industrial. We like a challenge here. We like to get, you know, I've talked about it before on the podcast. We're not interested in greenwashing. We want to really get, you know, we're going to get our hands dirty.
That's right. There's a kind of, again, we're back to the responsibility thing, aren't we? We have actually really impoverished the world for a lot of bird species. You know, they find it very, very difficult to find food, which is why so many of them are declining. So anything that we can do to improve that for them is fantastic. We've got a bit of a problem here at the moment, in that on our waters, we've got a lot of swans, and they've all come here naturally. They all appeared, and then they've bred, and they've bred, and they've bred. And the breeding swans all go off, and they take command of particular stretches of water, and they're very, very territorial. They won't let any other swans onto it, and they tend to chase the geese, which are our other birds, off it. But we do have a lot of Canada geese and greylags. And it's just been part of research recently has shown that geese carry a very heavy parasite load, much heavier than that of swans. And when they intermingle in the way that they do somewhere like this, it can weaken the swans hugely. And they then find it more difficult to feed. The geese anyway are taking some of the same feed. And we're getting quite a high cygnet loss because of that. Mm. So we've decided that we probably ought to get into supplementary feeding of our swans, and particularly of the cygnets when they appear. So we just started doing that. I mean, I don't know if you've come across that at all with your bird feed business, whether you've actually come up with anything that's specifically for swans.
No, I mean, we do have food that is fed to ducks, geese, and swans and so on. But I think a lot of our efforts go to asking people not to take a loaf of bread to ponds.
Yes,
because we hear that side, you know, leave that we're kind of worked with in the past, you know, Bill Oddie, for example. You know, we've done campaigns or marketed campaigns about leaving the loaf at home or use your loaf. Don't take the loaf type of thing.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of the problems we have because of the connection there with, well, the obvious thing. I mean, I've seen it myself around ponds and where people have thrown almost half a loaf of bread in and just, I don't know what they were expecting, really. It was almost enough to take to kill any bird, really, that's looking for feed. But I think I think we're in the supplementary, for us, obviously. I mean, when we talk about declines of species, you know, I think we as a company started to see, or in the early 2000s, hear people talking about declines of cockney sparrows and so on, and it seemed to be one or two populations. But then even starlings, which were seen as a nuisance in those early 2000s, we used to have letters from people, Nick, saying, "How do I get rid of starlings at the bird feeder because they eat everything and they arrive in this iridescent outfit that they've got, which is
they are beautiful
but they're
absolutely gorgeous. Starlings in the snow particularly look fantastic.
You're so right, that oil and water effect. But they arrive like the Hell's Angels, don't they, because they never are on their own. They're in groups of and so on, and they
I used to see huge murmurations here, and they'd be traveling, and you'd see this sort of huge dirigible cigar shape in the sky, which crossed the entire horizon, and then might wheel round and look fantastic. But I haven't seen a murmuration like that up here for a very long time. I mean, we do have, the house itself is a fantastic haven for birds. And I mean, one of our great kind of success stories, I mean, I wouldn't call it a success, but one of the great positive stories here is the house martins.
Yes.
And the house martins are on the red list here now, but not up here they aren't. They come back here every year, all the way from the south of the Sahara. They find their way back to where they were born. They nest again, they flock, and once the first and second broods are out, it's an amazing sight in the air. I think I sent you a little bit of film to illustrate that.
We are going to find someone very clever. We've got a few people here clever enough to, at this point, they'll put the videos on there so people can see them. But I'm absolutely blown away by them because
I sit and watch them for hours in the summer because they look so joyful apart from anything else, particularly when they've just fledged and they're learning to fly. And they often pair up and they fly around chasing each other and the insects. And of course, this growing of the grass has helped enormously because that produces more insects.
Insects.
It means we've had more swallows this year than we've had for quite a few years. And I'm sure that's because of the grass, because they fly low over the grass, skimming it for those insects. The house martins tend to go higher and catch the insects up there. And then up even above them are the swifts.
Yeah. You must be doing something right. Well, we've put swift boxes under our, because we're quite a modern plant here, really. But we've, under our eaves, which are about 7 meters high here, we've put swift boxes. So we're hoping to I think we're about 7 or 8 at the moment. So we're hoping to, I think with our ponds and everything else, but as you say, that keeping that grass a little bit longer is going to bring more insects.
Yeah.
These fly, but I find it's one of the most amazing stories, isn't it? That you will have these newly born house martins and will travel, as you say, all the way to the Sahara. That will be their
absolutely
first
extraordinary
major. It's just incredible.
I see them, I watch them, I call it ledge jumping. They practice for their flights, and they practice flying together. They all sit on a ledge, and then at some kind of given signal, whether it's a tweet or whether it's just a leader jumping off, they all get off together, and they all fly off together, and they wheel about. And I'm sure they're practicing keeping together for that long flight home. But it is, I mean, it absolutely astonishes me that they get all that, those thousands of miles back again.
Yes. Yes.
They managed to get past all those horrible people who are shooting little birds in European countries. Mm. They then go, people don't quite know where, south of the Sahara. And then back they come the next year. And it's an extraordinary ritual.
But it's amazing to think they could be flying through a rhino's, you know, legs, or sat on a giraffe, yeah, or wherever. And then they come back.
Yeah, yeah.
To Castle Howard.
I feel very kind of thankful to them. They still choose us to come back to. I mean, they do make a bit of a mess of the windows when they nest in the windows. There's six or seven chicks in there,
yes,
and they're being fed and they don't come out. So there's a bit of a streak down the windows. But to me, that's a kind of, it's a great sign that things are going on. Some people find it a little bit untidy and dirty,
yes,
but I'm very happy to leave it there. Yeah. Until they've gone, and then when they go, it's rather sad.
Mm.
And there's always a little sadness in that a few get left behind.
Yeah,
and you know they're never going to quite make it. So this year I counted three martins that I kept seeing, and a couple of swallows, and I was pretty certain they were never going to make it. And unfortunately, they're not going to last it through the winter here. But
yeah.
But there are plenty of others that will. And one of the things that seems to be on the up here are the pied wagtails, who, when the grass has been cut now, the grass that I was talking about, and it lay on the ground for a bit, and the wagtails absolutely loved that. And I've been seeing over the last few weeks really big flock of about, I suppose, 30 or 40 wagtails.
Wow.
All together.
That's
and
a lot.
They have this delightful way of flying. I mean, it's all in the name. They kind of, the tail goes up and down. They have a lovely sort of up and down movement. They get down on the ground. They look really excited seeing each other. It's, again, it's this lovely thing of seeing birds that appear to enjoy being with each other.
Yes. And it's a perfect name, isn't it, as well? Because you,
oh, yes,
pied wagtail. And when you see them on the ground, that's exactly what they look
it's
like.
Exactly what they look like. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you, we had in my previous home, we had a garage that was a door that wasn't, because this is, I suppose this might resonate on a much, much, much smaller scale, but we had a garage and the garage door didn't fit properly. So the house martins would find their way through that space, and they nested in the top of the garage space
inside. Because that's more like a swallow, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was an absolute nightmare. Because, well, nightmare. It wasn't really. It was, what we did was their drop-ins were all over the garage. But what we did, we just put a plastic sheet up, and that was fine. But one year we had the brainwave of repairing the garage door, and so we replaced it, and one day. When was it? Probably, I don't know, late spring, early spring. And on the aerial of the house, we looked up, and there they were, at the couple of house martins. And we thought, well, what are they waiting for? Because normally they go straight into the garage. We realized immediately the garage door obviously now fits right. I took one of the windows out. Well, within, faster than I can say, Castle Howard, the house martins were both inside the garage, and their work began. So they'd left.
Interesting story,
isn't it?
I love that. I absolutely love that. I mean, I every year as nesting season approaches, I have to kind of remind people to leave a few doors of outbuildings and things open, because I know the swallows like going in there.
Yes. Yeah.
And you see them, they come back and they're straight in, exactly the same way you're talking about. They're,
yeah,
straight into that old space. How they remember, I really don't know. How they navigate those thousands of miles to exactly this spot. It's just extraordinary. I used to think that the martins went back to the same window, but I'm told by martin experts that actually they probably just go to whatever's the most convenient window to get to. But
you mentioned leading earlier on, and I was talking about leading in the community and so on. You know, a different custodian of Castle Howard could feel very different. You they could decide to put I don't know, pigeon spikes up and so
on. Well, I'm afraid to say there is another of the houses, which I won't mention, but right. It's another very big stately home, who have done precisely that for the martins, who put spikes up to stop them nesting because they don't like the droppings on the windows.
Sure. And how does that make you feel when you hear that?
It makes me feel that they're kind of missing a trick, that they should be a bit more welcoming. But, I've mentioned this, and they'll probably change at some stage. I mean, I just think it's the natural thing to do. I mean, I love the birds on this house. And obviously, in the summer particularly, there are birds nesting everywhere. We've got the martins, we've mentioned the swallows, but there's pigeons, of course, everywhere, which occasionally one has to control. There's the starlings that you've mentioned. They nest on the house. There's jackdaws. There's the pied wagtails. There's goldfinches. There's wrens, there's the blackbirds and tits, there's the rooks and the crows and all the buzzards just out, not actually on the house. So, I mean, it's the wildlife here does become more and more varied. And I've watched red kites coming over and scouting, but nothing's actually nested on the estate yet. I rather look forward to the day when they do. Because they are the most beautiful birds to watch. Buzzards, I find kind of rather clumsy as flyers, but the red kites, the most beautiful, elegant flyers.
They're incredible, aren't they, to watch? I mean, that's that balance, isn't it, that you talk about here, this human nature balance at Castle Howard. But it sounds like it's very much in its explorative. You're exploring these things, aren't you?
But it's always been here. I mean, the fifth Earl of Carlisle wrote a long essay on how to make the best manure, what the right ingredients were, and so on. He was right into this, what was then the kind of the sort of cutting edge science of farming. So it's not new. This it'll always have been the case. So again, as I say, it's just the responsibility for the land. And there are delights that you see. I love it when the bluebells come out in the woods. You know, and that's got absolutely nothing to do with farming or anything I've done, other than maybe to have removed a few brambles. And there, of course, you can do it in lovely ways. There's a wood near, right beside the house, which was always a part of their sort of, you know, the grand design, in that it used to have a lot of statuary and winding paths and water in it, but the water never worked very well and was soon abandoned in the 18th century, and the statues were moved. But there's still a lot of stuff in there. And the last few years, we've been putting pigs in every year to clear the brambles, and they have the most amazing effect rootling around. They clear the ground, they open it up for things to grow out, and I'll be getting back into these woods in spring to see what's coming up where they've been rootling this year.
Yeah. And I guess these are the highs and lows of conservation initiatives. You never quite know what will happen. But look, it's interesting that you say these things have been around for a long time. So I suppose intensive farming, removing hedgerows, talking about, you know, how we move dikes and so on, so it affects water. It's starting to look at things in a smaller way. You're starting to...
Well, I think in your part of the world, down in Lincolnshire, I think there's been much more hedgerow removal than there has up here.
Right.
I mean, there are certain parts where hedges have sadly been removed, but there's a lot that are still there, and there's a lot that have been replanted. We don't seem to be laying them at the moment, but I think I'll try and persuade somebody to come in and do that. It's very expensive business.
It's wonderful to watch.
I love it. There's something incredibly satisfying about laying a hedge. Hedgerows are very much a part of our wilding scheme. In that it happens that in that area there are some that have been allowed to grow in the past, and so are really tremendous homes and food sources for birds. And we'll just let them grow out more.
Nick, I was going to say the rewilding it's a matter of leaving nature to kind of take over for a while, but you must have spaces where you've done that. You can't, you know, not everywhere can be manicured, and you don't want to manicure everywhere. So leaving spaces for nature, you know, where we may see dead wood and beetles and all sorts of other, you know, insects and so on is good.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And, you know, that there's a lot of woodland on this estate, and some of that, there's very little that you would actually call quite genuine ancient woodland, because there's a very specific description to that. Yes. I mean, there's one particular area, which I'm not going to tell you where it is, because, I mean, it's one of my favourite secret spots of this state. But you get, it's quite difficult to get in there, and you get in there, and suddenly you're on this bank, which has got mosses all over it. You've got ancient hazel coppicing. You've got wonderful gnarled old trees. You've got trunks lying on the ground. You've got bits of dampness. You've got flowers springing up. I mean, it's absolutely heavenly going there. It's very, very quiet.
Sounds magical.
But there is, I think, sort of almost more importantly, again in the 50s and the 60s, there were a lot of grants for what was effectively cropped timber. Mm. So you got these great tracts of softwoods everywhere, which were monocultures. And, you know, we were as guilty as anybody of planting like that, but those are gradually coming out now. And where they come out and we replant, we're replanting with a much more mixed woodland, to the end that eventually this will become ancient woodland.
Yes.
Because you get the mix. But it's an increasingly difficult thing to have to deal with this at the moment, because as temperatures change, as climate change starts to affect us, we have to start thinking about which trees we do plant.
Yes.
Because some of our native species are quite soon not really going to be suitable for the climate we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to think of bringing in things from further south, for instance, Turkey oaks more than our native oaks. We have to be looking at things from southern Europe rather than things that we think of as native to this country. Because in 50, 100 years' time, it's going to be so much hotter that those trees will not be happy. And trees are a long-term business if to perfection these plantations rise again. You know, you really are thinking for the future there.
That's fascinating.
We have oaks here, which we call the Armada oaks, because they were actually planted before the Armada and they escaped the wholesale felling of oak trees for the Armadas, for the ships that went on throughout most of the country. And they are wonderful, wonderful old trees. You almost feel you can talk to them. Sadly, we lost one the other day. It was blown over. But it still looks magnificent lying on the ground. I'll leave that there for as long as we possibly can. But, you know, it's our responsibility to be producing the trees now that in that amount of time other people will see as the most, as those beautiful wide trunk trees, tall, wide trunk trees. If we don't plant them now, then they, you know, they won't be there for the future.
I mean, we've all become very emotive recently about the cutting down of the sycamore gap.
Yeah,
and it's a funny one, isn't it? Because you mentioned about the oak leaving the oak on the ground and so on, and for me, you know, it became this. I think when I looked at it, I thought, well, actually, it's become this focal point for what we're doing elsewhere in the world. You know, we've been hearing about how many football pitches we lose a day in South America and so on, you know, and what's cut back for whatever reason, really, so we can normally we know what it is. But anyway, it's a challenging one, isn't it? Because,
well, I think the sycamore gap story is illustrative on all sorts of levels. You've got, for a start, it's a sycamore. And for a lot of people, sycamores are almost pests.
Mm.
You know, they will root anywhere they can find. They'll get suckers coming up all over the place.
Yes.
But leave a sycamore to grow, and it's a very beautiful tree. Mm. And as we can see from that one, you know, people love that tree. And there are a lot of sycamores that I'm very, very fond of. They suddenly change character. They're almost kind of Prince Hal's. They're these rather irritating, whippy things that grow up, and you know, you get them growing up all over the place. And then suddenly they turn into this mature tree, and you're thinking, oh, you're very beautiful. You've got a lot to offer us. So you've got that part of it, but you then got the kind of, you know, the mix of the built and the natural heritage. Because so when it fell over, it actually destroyed a bit of Hadrian's Wall. Now, Hadrian's Wall is obviously hugely important to us. Mm. So I think that was probably the reason they decided to cut it up rather than to leave it there as an insect home. I think probably also if they had left it there, people would have come along, take souvenirs of it, left, right, and centre.
Yeah.
So it's I mean, it's a kind of, it's a worthwhile story on all sorts of levels for us to think about. And it is, it is kind of rather gratifying, the outcry that there has been about that, really the sense of sadness. I mean, I have to admit that I've never seen it myself, but I mean, I knew photographs of it already very well. Yes. And it's amazing the number of photographs that have appeared online of it. You know,
Isn't it?
The number of people who've gone there and have taken really beautiful pictures, who waited until there's a moonless starlit night, and then they've taken it with the stars behind it, and all sorts of gorgeous pictures. Yeah. And I know there are people going along there almost as a sort of, I suppose, a sort of a trek to go to pay penance, to pay their respects to this dead tree.
And I read something interesting online where a chap was saying that, actually, you know, this is happening in everyone's gardens, as in, you know, metaphorically, but, you know, it's happening in people's locales. Make that trek there. You know, is that tree being cut down? Are we losing that hedge? Is that piece of, is that pond?
It's an incredibly important part of urban life as well. I mean, we saw the kind of the opposition that happened in Sheffield when they started cutting the trees down there. And it's happened in various cities. And it always astonishes me when I'm coming into Heathrow on a flight, flying over London, that it's an incredibly wooded city. I mean, it must be the biggest plane tree forest in the world. I mean, it's extraordinary coming over it in the summer. I mean, it's so green, which is obviously really important in cities. But of course, we in the countryside, we're an important part of that, because those trees have got to come from somewhere. So estates like ours have tree nurseries where we grow native trees and where people can come along and get them. And so I suppose we're both, it's a commercial thing for us. Obviously, we like to make a bit of money out of it, but we're also providing a service to the community there, in that, you know, you can come along and you know this tree hasn't come in with some terrible infested disease from Italy or Holland or China. You know that it's been grown from seed here. You know that it's safe, because so many of the diseases that are damaging our trees came in because people were impatient. They wanted to buy a bigger tree. They could only get them from Holland or Italy. And those trees came with diseases that were endemic in those parts of the world, and which none of our native species actually capable of dealing with.
Yes.
So you've got oak processionary moth. You've got ash dieback. You've got other oak diseases, you've got beech diseases, and they've all come in because people are too impatient to grow their trees from seed.
Yes. Well, we'll have to come to you for some trees then, I think that's it. But it's interesting about, you say about the cities. I interviewed a lady called Dr. Natalie Petarelli. She published a paper on rewilding our cities and how obviously doing more of that could help reduce or replace some of the biodiversity loss and help deal with the worst of climate change, which was interesting. But I suppose, what I would like to talk about, though, if you're okay I might be a million miles, but I think not everybody will see this podcast. So some people will just listen, perhaps in the vehicles and things, but your eyes light up as soon as you start talking about nature. And there's been a lot of talk recently about our mental health, mental well-being, and so on. I mean, it's just obvious to me. In a way, I wasn't quite sure. I hoped we'd talk more about wildlife and nature, but I wondered whether it would only be moments before we started to talk about bricks and mortar and so on. But your eyes light up as soon as we talk about the outside world.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, the pandemic was an appalling thing, and it caused devastation. It cost an enormous amount of money, and it hurt a lot of people, and it killed people. It was, you know, something I wish we hadn't had to go through. But being here during the pandemic was an extraordinary thing, because, of course, everyone went away. It was the first time I'd seen summer starting without anybody here in the grounds in my entire life. And it was, as my wife put it, it was a bit like being in the middle of a Russian novel. It was really extraordinary. But when people came back again, I started to see a side of it that I'd not really been conscious of before, which was this kind of the whole well-being side, that yes. people were coming in and their faces were lighting up as they came through the gates. They probably had their dogs with them. Their dogs' faces were lighting up. There was just this sense of being able to reconnect, of being able to be here again, and just being able to drink it in. And it was a lovely moment, actually, when the people came back. Although it had been extraordinary being here on our own, I think I was quite glad to see the return of other feet.
I was going to say to you, what's it like sharing your home really with complete strangers?
Well, I've never known anything else. My father opened it the year I was born, 1952. And so there've been people coming here ever since. In the early days, it was very much a kind of hands-on operation. My mother would sell tickets. My father would sell guidebooks. I would be outside giving pony rides for sixpence a go. It was very much a family operation. It's got so much bigger now and much, much more professional. In those days that we were open, I think it was sort of 4 half-days a week and a couple of full days. Now it's 7 days a week. We get 270,000 visitors a year. And just over Christmas alone, we get 80,000 visitors through the house. So it's a much, much bigger operation. But it's still to me, it's really important to just read people's faces and watch the tells, see what they're enjoying, look at how they're reacting to things. And that's true both indoors and outdoors. And indoors, it's a captive audience. And we have wonderful volunteers who man the rooms and who there as our room stewards. And I often talk to them and ask them about what the reactions of people has been to things.
Yes.
And that can help you kind of make little changes here and there. But also it can reassure you that you're on the right track. But outside, I can sit inside and watch people's body language as they're out there. And it's usually a very, very satisfying thing to do.
I can imagine.
There are some visitors who come here who come from foreign lands and really are in a hurry. And they come here and they jump off their bus and they come to a particular place. They take a photograph of themselves and they rush into the shop and then they rush onto their bus and rush away again. And I think, I think you'd enjoy it more if you gave yourself a bit more time. And it's that ability to come here and lose yourself in time. You can get here, maybe you have a cup of coffee when you arrive, then you walk out into the grounds and you get there and you find a bench to sit on. And then half an hour later, you realize you've been watching the swans and the geese or the ducks for all that time and you just got completely lost in it. You can move on somewhere else. You've got the wind in the trees. You've got the buildings looming up, the sunlight playing off them. It's, this time of year, the light is just so beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my favorite time of year from that point of view. I mean, I'm a photographer in another life. And I'll always look forward to this time of year arriving because you've got those beautiful, beautiful mornings when you've got the mists and the frost and the blue skies, temperature inversions. Either you go out and you've got the mist hanging over you, or I get my drone out and I take it above the mist and I'm just hoping to see buildings just poking out of the mist like it's some mysterious fairy tale. And then you get the lovely low sun, which gives those great shadows to everything, lovely contrasts. The light gets softer. It's just so beautiful, so beautiful.
I think it's fascinating that you sound to me just as excited as the next guest, really, that's walking through the gardens. That's amazing.
I think I'm going to paraphrase Dr. Johnson, the man who's bored of Castle Howard is bored of life. every day I get up and there's something I see that just amazes me. It's one of the lovely things about this house is that, you've got the stone on the house changes color with the light all the time.
Right.
It's fantastically reflective in different ways. It's got so many different colors in it. But one of the lovely things about this house is that throughout most of the house, you can actually see the house you're in because of the shape it is. It's like an E without the middle bit in it. So you're most of the time, particularly on one side of the house, you're looking out at other parts of the house. And you're watching it change colour, you're watching the shadows, you're in the summer, you're watching the martins all over it. Back to the martins again. And it encourages you out, apart from anything else.
Yeah, it sounds brilliant. Have you any, you know, in terms of, I know you've done a lot, we've already talked about your environmental footprint and so on, but what about any upcoming challenges or concerns, things that you're working on at the moment?
Well, you know, when you've got a 300-year-old building, and several 300-year-old buildings to look after, one of them is always falling apart. And I suppose the building I'm most concerned about at the moment is the mausoleum, which is this unbelievable structure designed by Hawksmoor. I mean, it's a very, very beautiful building. It serves its purpose really well. But you can't do much with it other than bury people in it. And it has probably at least 15 million to be spent on it. I mean, overall, we've got about what we call a conservation deficit, i.e. the money that has to be spent to bring buildings up to scratch, of about 50 million throughout the estate. So it's a sort of game that we're having to play all the time, chasing our tails, and trying to deal with that. And prioritizing that problem is always the great challenge. And so although the mausoleum is in the program, we've had to bring some of that forward recently, for instance, when we discovered that some remedial work we had done a few years ago is starting to leak at the edges, and we've got to deal with that quickly, because otherwise that'll compound the problem hugely, and suddenly it won't be 15 million, it'll be 25 million we have to spend on it. And obviously there are two things to do. One is to halt the decline, and the other is to make the repairs and the restorations. So that's the constant game, and that's the constant battle. But at the same time, there are things like, as I was talking about earlier, like the restoring of the tapestry room, which are really exciting. Yes. And there, you know, that's damage that's occurred since in 1940, which we're finally putting right. It's a long time later. It's whatever it is, 70 years later.
It's that challenge, isn't it? Balancing heritage and conservation.
Everything we achieve has that satisfaction to it.
Yes,
it's one more thing done.
Yeah, one more thing off the list. But by the time you tick that, you've got another 20.
There's another one on the other. Right. Yeah. It's still 50 million. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have a podcast to do as well, which is interesting, isn't it? How things have changed. Well, we're almost there, really. I mean, actually, you've got me thinking about guests for a moment. Over the years, you know, who's your favorite? You must have had some famous, you know, guests over the years come and see you.
Jolly. We've had a lot of guests. I mean, you know, we get the glitzy ones turn up when we've got a film going on, some sort of lovely film going on. But then also wonderful people turn up, like Mary Beard. And Mary Beard was here filming a little bit because we have a wonderful collection of antique sculpture, which goes back to about 50 BC, some of the oldest pieces. And there's one head that I know is mislabeled, because it simply doesn't look like the person the label says on it. And I said to Mary Beard, "Who is that? Do you know?" She said, "Oh, it's Cicero. Obviously it's Cicero." And of course I go and look up Cicero, and I see that there are endless busts of Cicero which look exactly like that. So, you know, it's fantastic when someone as knowledgeable as that appears.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, we work with as many knowledgeable people as possible. So when we're working on the tapestry room they're talking about, for instance, you know, there are an awful lot of people who we're working with whose expertise we're drawing on. Mm. And when you've got people who do have great expertise and great knowledge, it's so satisfying just sitting with them and having a conversation, because all this gold pours out of their mouths. It's a very satisfying thing. And then, yeah, but when you get the kind of the glitzy people, when you get the stars. I remember the first big movie we had made here was Lady L, which was a huge MGM production, directed by Peter Ustinov, with Sophia Loren, David Niven, Paul Newman, Cecil Parker in it. It flopped completely at the box office, but it was a mega production. And Sophia Loren was here a lot of the time, and she said at one moment, she said, "Do you eat pasta?" And we said, "Yes, yes, we love our spaghetti. We have it quite often. But you English, you don't know how to cook pasta. I will show you." And so she demanded that she would cook pasta spaghetti for us one night for dinner. And she went into the kitchen. There's a lot of fuss, and she was pushing the cook out of the way. And through she came with this bowl of spaghetti. It's probably the worst spaghetti I've ever eaten in my life. It was all stuck together and lumpy and disgusting and hard in the middle and soft on the outside. And I thought, yeah, you don't cook spaghetti for yourself very often, do you? I mean, I'd love to have been able to cook it for her sometime.
That's a lovely story. That's a lovely story. Well, I think if obviously we've got, we'll put some links so that people can find you over Christmas. So there's going to be 80, almost a Wembley Stadium of capacity of Wembley Stadium is going to be walking through your door over the Christmas period. That's fair. I hope you've got a nice welcome, Matt.
Oh yes.
Can we finish off with a little bit about nature, really? Just about, some people may be listening to this and thinking, well, this is all well and good, but, you know, I live in a small house, small garden. These are the wonderful thing that Nick and his family are doing at Castle Howard. But how can I, you know, how does that affect me? And I just wonder whether you could kind of boil some of the things down that you've done, even if it's from an inspirational angle or even from a practical level. What kind of things do you think our listeners can learn?
I think people should stop for a moment and think, reconsider how long they've been living in this place they're living in. If they've been there for a long time, they should think back to when they first got there and what the differences are in terms of bird numbers, particularly between then and now. If there's a bird that they used to see a lot of, but they don't see very much of now, then I would start feeding to bring that bird back. So it probably means that it's a native of that part of the world. And it doesn't take much, as we've been talking about earlier, it doesn't take much to get these birds coming back. So look more specifically at the bird types you've got and feed them accordingly. But also, again, as we've talked about before, see if you've got a bit of area where you could just allow the grass to grow up a bit, allow the natural vegetation to take place so that you've got a place for the insects to breed. So you've got a natural food source for your birds. And you don't have to turn your back garden into nep in order to be able to see advantages. You can probably be more relaxed. Don't mow your lawn as much, probably. Definitely do not put down plastic grass. That would be my number one piece of advice. I do think one of the most iniquitous things in the world is the plastic lawn. I think it's horrible. And every time, and developers use them sometimes in order to make life easier for themselves, it's the most appalling thing. You're completely decarpeting over biodiversity. Any chance of it, any small biodiversity that might happen in your corner of the woods has no chance if you do that. So don't use plastic grass. That's the one thing I would say. Make sure there's plenty of water for the animals. Make sure there's food. Make sure there's a place where something can happen naturally. And I think, you know, just those small things, you will see a change. And it's being patient as well. If you do make any changes, you're not going to see it tomorrow. You're going to see it over the course of a year or so. It's, you know, when you look in spring and you start seeing more birds of a particular breed coming back in there because they know they can breed there, they know that they can get food there, and they learn, they remember. They have these extraordinary memories, birds.
Yeah. Nick, that's wonderful. It's a great point to leave on. I think I'm going to do that with mine. You know, I can see the house we live in is a 1930s, you know, arts and crafts type thing. But actually, when I think back to the house we moved in, we've changed some things, but there are lots of things just sitting and just observing a little bit more. I mean, we feed the birds very actively, but actually, you know, I think I could just be a little more patient with things really as well.
Yeah. With your bird feeders, it's where you put them as well. I mean, if you have it too close to the house, lovely having it close to the house, you can watch them. But you have to think that quite a lot of birds are fairly timid. Mm-hmm. So if you put it too close to the house, they're going to think twice before coming onto it. Obviously you want to try and keep squirrels away from it, but you know, I'm sure you've got lots of good solutions for that.
And another nice import, the grey squirrel. Right. Somebody thought that would be entertaining. It's continued to be entertaining, but challenging as well.
I'm afraid if there was one animal I could get rid of, that would be it. I mean, the damage they do to trees is terrible, the way they ring bark them, and then the tree falls down. I've seen so many promising young trees completely killed by grey squirrels. Very sad.
It's a challenge, isn't it, really? Mm. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Nick? I'm going to leave the closing off this podcast with you, really, because you've been kind enough to, and I think everything you've said, really, people can think about those things in the garden. I think it's a fair comment. I mean,
continue on just a little bit further with what I was saying about people's own gardens. You don't have to do very much sometimes to make a big difference. Very often it's a question of just leaving things alone and allowing nature to take its course. But you shouldn't think that if you do that, it will always come out for the best, because it can be very messy. So you shouldn't be afraid to get stuck in and take out things like ragwort. You shouldn't be afraid to get rid of what really are still weeds, which are destroying things. But you can, with a little bit of cooperation, you can make a huge difference. We have a Himalayan balsam problem here. But ever since our volunteers started building up in numbers, we found it much easier to deal with, because you attack it at the right moment, you can catch the seeds, which tend to explode everywhere. You can take it down, you can hold it back, and then it gradually starts receding again. And it's really gratifying seeing that. And if you do lots of little things, it's seeing those things adding up that really makes the difference.
Yeah. Nikhil, thank you very much for your time today. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to come and see you over Christmas. Bring my family.
Good. I'll have you enjoy it. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you, Nick.
Very good to see you.
Right, Nick. I've stopped that recording there.